True words indeed. Let's all love one another right now. You are listening to KWMR, 90.5 Point Reyes Station, 89.9 Bolinas, and 92.3 San Geronimo Valley. Coming up here is the West Marin Naturalist Hour with myself, Seamus, along with Dallas and Liz here in the studio. Before we yak away with some fun guests today, I'm really excited about today. But let's play our little intro song. Be right back. Here we are. The band's back together for the West Marin Naturalist Hour. Liz, I think you got a quick message for us. Yeah?
I sure do. KWMR is underwritten by the Rotary Club of West Marin, a service organization that supports good work in our community and around the world. The Rotary Club meets on Wednesday mornings at 8:30 and hosts speakers twice a month. See more information at rotaryclubwestmarin.com.
All right. I wasn't expecting rain this morning. That was a little.
I wasn't either. Yeah.
That's a fun little surprise.
Neither was our outdoor furniture.
I know. I left the dog out this morning and came back in soaking wet, and I was like, "Oh, okay,
what?
Well, good little weather check."
Yeah.
And actually, speaking about weather, let's jump in for the rest of the week. Looks like we have another warm week ahead of us with sunny days in our forecast through the weekend.
Yay!
Like, I know.
I'll take it.
Highs up to the upper 60s. I think like almost 70 degrees on Friday.
Ooh, good.
And lows in the upper 40s. Yeah, right. Good for that. We have a Magnolia Project tour on Friday, and I think we have a few more spots left.
But so. The kids leading.
Oh, yeah. Sweet.
Totally. Exactly. Yeah. Student-led trips this week, so knock on wood for some good weather. And then for tides, if you're heading out in the water, for Marshall, our tides are next high tides 5.7 feet at 10:48 a.m., and our next low tide is a low one at negative 0.5 at 5:54 p.m. And now I'll pass it off to Liz to introduce today's guest.
Thanks so much. We are so excited about today's guests. We have the filmmakers from the film Sequoias of the Sea joining us today here, Natasha Benjamin and Ana Blanco. And wow, what a film. We're so excited to take a deep dive into that. But a little bit about each of them first. Natasha is a marine scientist and filmmaker dedicated to protecting our oceans. She's based in Northern California and has spent over two decades working in ocean conservation and communications. And then Ana Blanco is the executive director of the International Ocean Film Festival, leading a large group of volunteers to produce a four-day flagship event since 2011. And so last year, this film debuted there. And there's lots of exciting stuff coming up with that film fest shortly. We'll maybe tap into that at the end of the show. But welcome to the show. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for
Thank you for
us.
Having us.
Absolutely.
I know your film was just at the Dance Palace not that long ago.
It was a hit. It sold out, right?
Yep. Totally sold out. Standing room only. And very, very excited to show the film in Point Reyes Station.
Awesome. And let's start off with talking about the title of the film, I think. So it's Sequoias of the...
Of the Sea.
Of the Sea. We're talking about land or ocean? I'm getting confused. No, Sequoias of the Sea. Sequoias, as we know, are the giant trees that we get both in the Sierras and also the redwoods are a type of sequoia. What brought the title Sequoias of the Sea? We're talking about kelp, right? And referring to kelp as like a kind of an underwater seabed, right? or forest, underwater forest.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think, you know, Anna and I, when during this process of making this film and trying to tell the story of kelp in Northern California, we saw a lot of parallels between what was happening on land and what was happening on the ocean. And I think people understand what's happening on land because they can see it.
Right.
These kelp forests are below the surface. They're underwater, and not many people know about what's going on with kelp and why they should care about kelp. And that's really why we made the film. And, you know, if really the premise of the film is we lost 95% of our kelp forests along the northern coast of California, including Marin, Sonoma, Mendocino. And this is all hidden below the surface.
Yeah. That happened fast, too.
Yeah.
Really fast.
And is, I guess, geographically, that's where that big section was. Is the entire coast of California affected, or did we really see most of that loss right here, like you said, Marin, Sonoma, and Mendocino coasts?
So the 95% loss that we're talking about happened in that stretch.
Okay.
But we're seeing kelp loss and biodiversity loss up and down the entire west coast of the U.S., including in Southern California. But this is kind of the epicenter. Marin, Sonoma, Mendocino is the epicenter of this collapse that happened over a very short period of time, like you said, you know, less than 10 years.
Wow. And it is, I mean, a film like this is, I guess, is so important to point out these calamities because we can't visually take that in. We can look at a forest fire or, you know, a forest burned and see the ecological impact. When you look out of the ocean, you're just seeing the ocean. You don't really, you're not really paying, like, it's just
a lot harder to
your
see.
Senses aren't taking in some of that loss. So I think it makes it all the more important to bring up in a film like this, this calamity that's happened.
Well, I also just wanted to chime in, Seamus, that, like, why are the kelp forests important?
Yeah.
If Natasha or Anna wants to chime in with a little bit about that, like, it's devastating to hear that 90% have been lost, but what's like, services do they, like, ecological services, what are these bull kelp forests, what do they do in the ocean?
Great question. Why should we care about the, you know, seaweed? Most of us, you know, if you're a surfer or a diver, you get tangled in it. Or if you walk on the beach, it's like piled up and it's stinky and it's slimy. People kind of have this interesting relationship with seaweed. And I wasn't really a seaweed person until we started making this film. But now I'm totally into the whole seaweed kelp thing.
It's also delicious.
Totally.
Absolutely.
And it's amazing. You can eat almost all of the seaweed that you see here on our coast.
Yeah.
It's all edible. It's all really nutritious and amazing. Totally. But so besides eating it, it's extremely important for our ocean ecosystem. It is the nursery ground. It is the kind of apartment building infrastructure for everything that lives off our coast. Mm-hmm. You know, imagine like the forest on land. It's where, you know, there's different animals that live at different levels of the forest, the bottom of the forest, the tops, the birds. It's the same thing underwater. And we, in addition, also kelp forests help with coastal erosion and storm surge. They protect our coasts. They reduce wind chop along, you know, along the ocean, which, you know, creates beautiful waves for surfers. Kelp forests and these giant algae are extremely important for all different kind of ecosystem services. And they sequester carbon. They absorb carbon just like, you know, plants on land. Even though they're not a plant, they're an algae. But they're really, really important. And when you lose that ecosystem, you know, there's obviously huge impacts.
Yeah, including, you know, I noticed one of the elements in some of the clips I've seen of the film, you tie kind of the livelihoods of some of the coastal communities to these kelp beds and how they can support local coastal communities either through fishing or other means. But so the benefits are lost, like directly affects some of the people that live on the California coast, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Anna, do you want to talk a little bit
sure.
about that?
Sure. There's a lot of people who depend on the kelp forest. For example, all of the commercial urchin divers are deeply invested in having healthy kelp. The abalone community as well, whether you were a recreational diver or not, that affected much of the kelp. And also in our film, we show the native tribes up in Fort Bragg. And for them, the kelp forests are critical to their culture, their ceremonies, their regalia. And for them to have lost access to that kelp is really devastating for them. And it's very interesting to hear their point of view and why it's important to them. So you get many different varieties of people and circumstances and businesses that are dependent on a healthy kelp forest.
Mm-hmm. And I kind of want to take a step back for a second. Can you explain to folks what kelp we're talking about?
Sure. So we're specifically talking about bull kelp. In the film, it focuses on bull kelp, which is a giant brown algae that grows from kind of central California up through Alaska. And right around the Bay Area, kind of Monterey Bay Area, we shift. If you go south, you shift to giant kelp. Mm-hmm. And most people, I think when they imagine kelp, like if you've been to the Monterey Bay Aquarium, that's giant kelp. It's a different species. It has a different life cycle. It's a perennial species, so it can live for multiple seasons, multiple years. It has leaves or fronds that grow from the bottom versus bull kelp, which gets its name from like a bull whip, mm-hmm. has a long stalk and then the leaves just at the surface and a bladder that helps it float at the top. Mm-hmm. And that the bull kelp is an annual species. So it starts growing in the spring. It kind of reaches the surface, like 100 feet tall. It can grow, by the summer, the end of the summer. And then when the winter storms come, it usually gets ripped out. So, that's part of the story of why it was so impacted is because every year it has to start over again versus the giant kelp in Southern California, which can live multiple seasons, multiple years, and keep reproducing in that way.
That was actually new to me. I didn't realize it was an annual as well because, I know the giant kelp was all around, so it was just kind of blew my mind. I was like, oh, that's a huge hole in my knowledge I didn't realize. So
yeah, that one was perennial, one was annual.
Totally, and it makes it even more impressive, when you see how tall they can be and, as you call them, like the sequoias of the sea, like they really are just so massive. And to do all of that and accomplish all of that in that amount of time means it's like you have to have the perfect situations to really line up. So I love that comparison of the sequoia of the sea. So thank you for stepping back. Just because we were talking so much about the kelp, I wanted to make sure.
That's important. And it's an important piece of the story because when we had this perfect storm of conditions that killed off all the kelp on the North Coast, there was no other kelp in the system really to help it grow back because once you lose that kelp, it's not there anymore, obviously.
So that gives me two questions. What were those conditions of the perfect storm that led to this decline? And two, since they're an annual, is there, replanting efforts or something like that?
So great questions. We call it the perfect storm. It happened about 10 years ago. Actually started in kind of 2013, 2014. We had this marine heat wave where it got really hot underwater. It was called the warm water blob, was actually the scientific term for it. And if you're an ocean person, you felt it. The water was warmer that year. And kelp needs cold, nutrient-rich water. And when there wasn't that the ocean conditions weren't right, the kelp started to die off. And at the same time, there was a disease that was triggered that took over the entire west coast of California and killed off all of the sea stars.
Right.
We have many different species of sea stars, small ones, big ones, and it killed them all. We didn't really know what it was. We knew it was some kind of virus or bacteria. It's called sea star wasting disease. The sea stars, which we used to call starfish, but they're not fish, so we call them sea stars now, they just started to disintegrate. They literally were just melting on the seafloor and dying, and it was horrible. And there's one particular sea star, the sunflower sea star, which gets huge. We're talking, you know, it's, you know, few feet across, it can get a few feet across, dozens of arms, and it is one of the main keystone predators in the kelp forest. And this disease wiped out all of the sea stars, and the sunflower sea star went locally extinct. And this predator is the only predator for the purple sea urchin. Mm-hmm. And when we lost the kelp and we lost the sea stars, the purple sea urchins took over. And now where there once was a lush kelp forest, there's just a desert, a carpet of these little purple sea urchins. And that, you know, that's really what shifted, you know, about 10 years ago. And we haven't been able to reshift the balance in the ecosystem. And these purple sea urchins don't have any predators. The sunflower sea star did not come back. Other sea stars did over the last few years. We're seeing them in the tide pools. But the sunflower sea star has basically locally extinct, which is really devastating. There are efforts to bring it back, which is exciting. And there's hope there. But until we figure out how to bring the sea star back and we figure out how to remove these purple sea urchins at scale, it's going to be really hard for the kelp to grow back.
I like that you mentioned at scale, because there is like, I don't know that necessarily Reef Check was doing this, but there, I know they do other things. But there's lots of people going out to harvest those purple urchins, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And getting creative with it too.
they're kind of like the out of control lumberjacks of the ocean, right? Or of the California coast, right? Like do they just feed off of the bull kelp, or are they voracious eaters of all type of
they're opportunistic, so they'll eat anything. But what's crazy is that there's not a lot of food in the system right now because it's totally out of balance. There's no giant kelp. There's no bull. You know, there's no bull kelp. And so they're starving. These little, there's billions of them. If you go dive down, you'll just see this carpet, and they're starving and they're empty. And, you know, everyone's like, well, why don't we just harvest them and eat them? But they're, you know, when you harvest urchin, you eat we eat uni, that's what we call it, which is the inside of the urchin, which is actually the gonads of the urchin. And they're all empty and starving. So, but they can live like that for years. They can go into this zombie hibernation.
I was wondering about that, because I kept having this thought, like, eventually they'll die off from lack of food. But no. they go into like more of a hibernating state, huh?
Yeah.
Wow.
So they literally are zombies. Oh, and man. We are trying, there's companies and institutions and scientists that are working together to harvest some of these empty, starving urchins, bring them on land, feed them, and fatten them up, and then bring them to market and try to get them into restaurants and try to get people to start eating the problem.
Interesting. I didn't realize that was a roadblock or conundrum to that whole process.
I know at one point someone was like actually crumbling them up and trying to use it for like building material as well.
Oh, really?
You know? Yeah, it was a different, you know, and I was like, I love your creativity.
Sea urchins can make a great cement, I hear.
Well, I mean, I love the creativity though.
Yeah, they're actually, Anna and I were just talking about this. There's a woman in Berkeley who is taking the sea urchins and creating a bio marble with them. The name of the company is Marvelous, and the material is called urchinite.
Thank you.
And the idea is to build these countertops with urchins. And it also kind of be a way to tell the kelp story, the kelp urchin story. And that's exciting because that's kind of a market-based solution. Because right now, people can go remove these urchins, but we don't really know what to do with them. And there's too many of them. But if we could create a market for them, then that could be, you know, really important in these restoration efforts.
And money comes up in a lot of these conservation conversations and whatnot. And part of that story comes through in your story, talking about how it's economically impacted these different communities along the way, along with the cultural impact. But yeah, creating some kind of economic driving force to to help clear those guys out. That's really smart.
And another looking at reintroducing the sea otter out here, like specifically in Point Reyes in the area. And do you think that that all would help with the kelp beds, you know, like reducing the purple urchin? Are they targeting different, do you think, or?
I'll take that one, if I may, Natasha. It's been very interesting, the whole sea otter story relative to the disappearing kelp forest. And, you know, a lot of people are advocating for bringing back the sea otters. I think the challenge is, you know, they've been extinct in Northern California. They were hunted to extinction a long time ago. And it's not like you can just bring them back and drop them in the water and they're going to go down and eat just the purple urchin.
Right.
They're going to eat whatever's available. Mm-hmm. And it would take a really, really long time to reintroduce them. But I know that a lot of folks are exploring that option. Another criticism I've heard, which I find fascinating, is that some people who criticize it think that those who are advocating for it are looking for the opportunity for it to be a tourist attraction, similar to what it's like in Monterey. So there's a lot of different opinions and, you know, perspectives on whether or not it could happen and what kind of effect it would have. I think it's too early to tell, but there's a lot of people working on what the possibilities are and what the impacts would be.
And it sounds like it wouldn't be something that's a quick fix.
Right. Especially
correct.
The big point with them, like eating whatever's available. Like out here, there's tons of innkeeper worms and so many other things that's higher up on their diet that would make more sense. So,
also, are they going to be eating the urchin if there's nothing in them?
Right.
Correct.
Yep. That's probably the biggest thing in terms of I mean, I think we all know that otters should be on this coast. They were here hundreds of years ago, and they are part of, you know, they're a keystone predator. And if they had been here, then this 95% loss might have been less because there would have been some kind of balance in the ecosystem. There would have been another predator. But they're not going to eat these empty purple urchins. Right. They're smart. They know what's nutritious, and it takes them a lot of energy to dive down and get, you know, their food. So they're not going to be eating these empty, you know, purple urchins. They're probably going to go for, you know, mussels and clams and abalone, which is, you know, that's a big concern.
Yeah.
And crabs and, you know, and other important commercial fisheries and important other creatures that other people depend on. So it is, like Anna said, it's controversial and it's complicated and it's going to take time, and it's not a magic, you know, solution.
No.
Countertops first.
I was going to say countertops first, exactly what I was going to say.
And sunflower sea stars.
Yes.
I mean, is there looking at ways to combat this or change the tide here? Pun not intended, actually. But there's not really any quick fixes to this situation, is there? And we can definitely get into some of the restoration efforts and some of the work in response to this devastation. But it's not like there's nothing that is really going to change the situation fast.
I mean, it's a climate story.
Yeah.
It's
an
ocean-changing story that's happening all over the world in different ways. This is kind of the North Coast California story. And there is no quick fix, but really it's down to reducing carbon emissions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a big elephant in the room with this whole conversation is climate change.
Yeah, and our dependence on oil and fossil fuels.
Yeah.
If we continue on this path, we will, and I mean, even if we don't continue, even if we stop today, we're going to continue to see these marine heat waves, and we're going to see them, they're going to be more severe, they're going to be more frequent, and that's really the big issue here.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. So I mean, it's hard to think of this kind of event that happened in 2013, 2014 as a one-off scenario.
Well, and that was kind of the start of it. We've had some other guests on the show. It's like the oceans had a temperature, you know, like a fever.
Like a fever, right?
Like a decade. So.
Yeah, we've been we're full-time kayak guides out here, so we spend a lot of time on the water. And we were actually on the water in 2013, and you know, during that time, and we noticed the big change, and it felt so significant, you know. So the fact that we're still talking about it here in 2026, you know, and honestly still figuring out a lot of what happened. It's a complex situation, you know. And awesome, great on you guys for doing this movie, because you know, to be shedding this light on folks, you know, this far, you know, into the situation, it's amazing, and you guys did a fantastic job of talking to all the different communities, which I almost want to jump into it. We have to stop for a break here.
Yeah, we'll take our mid show break.
yeah. If you're all just tuning in, this is an awesome conversation. We're talking with Natasha Benjamin and Anna Blanco. About the film they just did.
Sequoias of the Sea.
Sequoias of the Sea. And this is KWMR, and this is Westbury Natural Style. We're going to play a quick song.
Before we jump into that, is there another showing for folks for the next showing? I popped online. I didn't have that readily available in front of me.
So our next show is Bioneers, right, Anna?
Oh, great.
Awesome.
Yeah, we're going to be at Bioneers, I believe, on Thursday, March 28th, I believe.
26th
at 8:40 p.m., and that's in Berkeley. It's part of the Bioneers Conference. We're also planning to be on April 25th, which is a Saturday, in Tam Valley. They have a community district there, and we're hoping to show the film for Earth Day. So that's a nice little gathering in Mill Valley down there. And we're constantly working on additional screenings. You know, we get a lot of interest from the community. So, but we keep updating the website. That's probably the best source for finding out when the next one is.
And remind us again the website name?
SequoiasOfTheSea.org.
Perfect.
Nice.
All right, with that, we'll jump into our mid-show break, and we'll talk a little more about the communities afterwards.
All right. So this is a song by Dirtwire called "The Whip."
I tried to find songs about bull kelp specifically, you know, and like I wasn't finding a whole lot that weren't kids, you know. So this gets close. So
right. Here we go.
I like it.
We'll be right back.
All right.
And we are back, the West Marin Naturalist Hour on KWMR, talking about Sequoias of the Sea, the film that just came out. Liz, why don't you start us off?
KWMR would like to thank its signal sponsor, Palace Market, locally owned and operated in downtown Point Reyes Station. Palace Market is a full-service independent grocer offering groceries, local and organic products, freshly prepared meals, housewares, and wellness items for everyday life on the coast. More information at palacemarket.com. And back to our show with Sequoias of the Sea, the filmmakers here, Natasha and Anna. We wanted to start off this next segment with kind of what inspired you. So obviously, you both are conservationists. You care about the world's oceans and climate change and all of that. But what brought you two together for this project, and what was sort of that spark behind it all?
So great question. Natasha and I have been working together here in the Bay Area on ocean conservation for probably the last dozen years or so. And in May of 2021, during the pandemic, her father came to visit, and he is a film director in his own right. And I said, let's have lunch with your dad. And so we went, sat outside, and talked a lot about films. And Natasha had been diving, and she noticed firsthand the loss of the kelp forest. And so we were chatting, and she asked me if there were any films in the International Ocean Film Festival that were about the disappearing kelp. And at the time, there were none, really. And so her dad, without skipping a beat, said, well, why don't you two make a film? And so we looked at each other. At first, we laughed, and then we thought, well, why not? And now that's almost 5 years ago. And it just took us on this journey of using both of our knowledge, you know, her as marine biologist, both as ocean lovers, my experience with the International Ocean Film Festival, and really using the power of film to tell a story that needs to be told, giving the ocean a voice, especially a problem that affects all of us, and yet most people don't know about it because you can't really see it, right? I think in all of our screenings, that's been the one thing people have come up to us afterwards and said, oh my gosh, I'm so glad you did this film because I didn't know this was happening. And that's exactly why independent film, especially for ocean conservation, is so important.
And some of the images in your...
Well said.
Absolutely. you know, some of the clips I've seen from the movie are visually striking.
Stunning.
And especially like the urchin barren landscape underwater would just kind of blew my mind to like visually see that in such detail. And it really felt like, a clear-cutted forest with all these little purple urchins around. It was wild.
Yeah, and that's the power of film, is most people don't get to see that. So that imagery is really important, and I think very powerful. And whether it's a full-length feature film or we, you know, kind of shorter content that we can create to illustrate the story in a way, because it's hard to imagine when you say you lost 95% of a forest, what does that really mean?
And we're such visual species, you know, in terms of like instructing how we feel empathy and all these things. Visual cues are so important for us. And so especially for something like this, it's just the images of it were quite striking. And in filming some of those, was there any challenges filming underwater and capturing some of these images?
It's got to be, because I know as working on the water is so, you know, tough to deal with all the elements, you know.
Filming underwater is very challenging. You know, we had some friends that came and filmed for us. And, you know, people who are experienced in filming underwater, it has its own, you know, set of parameters and safety nets and equipment, et cetera. So we were very lucky to work with some close friends and other filmmakers and really be able to acquire some of that really special footage of the kelp forest, of the urchin barrens, and really enabled us to tell a good story.
Yeah, and you know, and actually talking about, you know, you guys did a great job of, like, talking with all the different communities, kind of circling back to the, you know, that conversation with you, Anna, at the beginning. You know, it must have been so hard to how to include all of that into that. Was there stuff that didn't make it into the film?
Yeah, well, you know, there's always stuff that doesn't make it into a film, and that's the hardest part. I think when we started out, we thought this would be a 35-minute film, and now it's a 54-minute film.
Oh, wow.
Because we just realized there were so many parts and pieces that we wanted to add. And because this isn't a scripted film, we every trip we took to Fort Bragg, you know, we just filmed as much as we could. And we just collected as much information, as many interviews, as much B-roll as we possibly could, and then put the pieces together to tell the story that we're telling. So, yes, a lot doesn't get in, but I think at the end of the day, you know, we were fortunate that the community was open and willing to talk to us. They had some great examples of restoration work that they're doing. And, you know, we've all become friends in a way, if you will. And it's just they love the film, and it's just really nice to be able to tell the story because, you know, it takes a lot of work for what they're doing. And they all came together. And so it's very special because it is Fort Bragg. And I think telling their story, you know, they wanted their story to be told. And so it was, you know, it was fun for us to be able to have that kind of a reception.
Yeah. I'm really curious on some of the restoration efforts that are underway and highlighted in your film in response to this.
I was going
to
say that it was such a deep subject, you know, like what's giving you hope right now?
Yeah. Yeah.
There are some great stories of hope throughout the film, and then just what's been happening since we finished the film. One of the it wasn't a restoration site at the beginning, but Big River at the mouth of the Big River in the town of Mendocino, it wasn't impacted at first. There was still some healthy kelp there, but about 3 years ago, they lost all of the kelp. The urchins came in, and I think the urchins had somehow like missed that spot for a few years, which was really interesting. And I believe, and a few of the scientists have been saying this, is that they don't like fresh water.
Yeah.
So you tend not to find them, or there's less of them, or once you remove them, they don't come back where at a spot that has a freshwater inflow.
More brackish water.
Yep.
And the kelp doesn't seem to mind brackish.
No, and the kelp actually, I think, likes it and kind of thrives in those areas. But the urchins seem to, and it's, you know, I think they're still trying to figure this out. But that's one of the many theories out there why Big River wasn't affected by the urchins so much. And then I think there was some kind of situation where we lost the kelp and the urchins did come in, but once they were removed and they started doing what they call kelp enhancement and bringing in actually baby kelps on lines above the urchins and growing them, they saw a 900% increase of kelp over 2 years in that little spot right there in Mendocino.
That's amazing.
So I think, you know, that's really giving the restoration community a lot of hope. Of like, we can restore these ecosystems. It took a few years to figure out the best methods for removal and for urchin removal and for kelp enhancement and growing kelp. And I think they're figuring it out now. They're working with folks up in Oregon and Washington who have been doing some of this work and internationally. And so we are seeing, you know, some examples, very small, right? And we talked about this before, like how do we scale this? But we're starting to understand how to do this restoration.
Something do you happen to know what group that is? Or are there a couple groups doing that just so we can give them a shout out and people should give them money?
Yes. So the Nature Conservancy, the California Nature Conservancy has been spearheading a lot of the restoration efforts on the North Coast. And they work with many partners. I'll try to name a few of them. Reef Check being one. They've been working very closely with Reef Check. Reef Check is in the film. Reef Check has been instrumental in a lot of the restoration efforts and the monitoring. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't know what's happening unless you're out there monitoring. And Reef Check is an amazing organization.
Anyone who's data sets.
Certified can join and become a citizen science diver and go learn how to be a kelp restoration diver.
One thing you mentioned that was – if you have another point to make.
Go ahead.
A burning question because I found it really interesting that you mentioned is growing the kelp above the sea floor. to avoid the urchins. What does that entail? That sounds fascinating to me. And it makes it hard, assuming the urchins aren't very good jumpers, they might have a harder time getting to the kelp if it's raised above the... Because the kelp urchins have a hold flask, right? They have like a hold flask holding them to the...
Exactly. Yeah. So kelp doesn't have a root system like seagrass or mangroves. Yeah. They have a hold fast, which is basically it sticks to a rock to keep it submerged and keep it stuck to the bottom of the seafloor so that it can grow. And so you can take these little, they're growing baby kelp at Moss Landing Marine Lab, Bodega Marine Lab. And they're using this kelp that they're farming basically on land and on land systems. And then they're attaching them to lines that are on these like PVC pipes that are a few feet above the bottom of the seafloor. And urchins can't jump. They can, they can move around quite a bit, but they can't jump and they can't climb up these systems. So you're growing it above the hungry urchins and it's working. And it's pretty amazing this has just happened over the last couple of years. So this is kind of brand new technology.
Wow, that is pretty wild.
But it's intensive, right? Like you got to grow the kelp. You got to get it out there. You got to put it on these lines. And then you have to put these lines in the water, which involves a boat.
Yeah.
And, the fishing community up in Fort Bragg has been really involved in these restoration efforts. So you see a lot of commercial fishermen that are now restoration divers and helping with this process. So I want to also do a shout out to Grant Downey, one of those commercial fishermen who we spent a lot of time with and who's in the film and has been unbelievable in terms of working with the scientific community, being, creative on different ideas on how to remove urchins and how to plant kelp and working really closely with the tribes and the scientists and the environmental groups and everyone.
I bet this has impacted a lot of commercial fishery operations up and down the coast with less kelp because there's less other creatures for them to fish, right? Because of the loss of habitat.
Yeah, and so the urchin fishery on the California coast was based on red urchins, which are larger. And the reason why they focused on reds was because they're larger and they're easier to process. And the smaller purple urchins were always there. They were just less of them. And no one really was, there was lots of red urchins, so they went for the bigger ones. But the when the purple sea urchins took over, they pushed the red ones out into deeper waters.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow.
And now the red urchins have been really impacted, and the entire commercial urchin fishery has basically collapsed and been declared a disaster the federal level. And all these guys, and this was a huge fishery on the North Coast, all of these guys are out of work. And the whole infrastructure and the processing plants that were in Fort Bragg and on the North Coast have disappeared. And that kind of whole infrastructure and fishery is gone. So a lot of these guys have either retired, left the fishery and are fishing other things, or they're working on the restoration diving now.
Wow. Interesting. Very interesting. What about policy in all this, like policy advocacy? How is that playing any sort of significant part, or has there been any sort of shifts on any sort of governmental level or in addressing this?
So there is, this is something we're working on now that the film is out. We're, trying to build kind of an action campaign, an engagement campaign. And policy is one of the pieces that we're working on. And there is a bill at the federal level that would go towards kelp restoration. It's called Help the Kelp Act that Jared Huffman introduced, your local representative. Mm-hmm. And we're working on that. It's interesting because it's kind of a bipartisan bill at this point because it's also works with kelp farmers in Alaska and Maine. So it's, and also restoration work for wild kelp. So, We're hopeful on that, but it's not enough. We need more. So we're starting to think about not just, you know, state, there's state policies, there's federal policies, and then there's global policies. So we're thinking about this and trying to figure out kind of the best policy levels. But at the same time, in order to build policy, we need to create awareness.
Yeah.
That's why we've got the film. Yeah. That's why we're launching this impact campaign. And we kind of need to do both at the same time. So we need funding, and we need, you know, climate change reform, basically. Mm-hmm. So it's a big subject, but there's a lot of groups that are working on this, and the Kelp Forest Alliance, which is a global organization working on kelp forest restoration. So we're starting to talk to them and try to build coalitions around this.
So I know your film is focused a lot on this part of the California coast, the Northern California coast. I'm assuming, and I think I've heard, as a kayak guide, when I was around this time, I was guiding in the San Juan Islands in Washington, and I know up there was also a lot of habitat loss for the kelp. So I'm assuming it's a really similar story with kelp, especially the bull kelp loss, all up the coast up into Alaska, right?
Yeah, you know, it's called the Kelp Highway from Alaska to Baja, basically. There's this strip of kelp that has existed for, you know, thousands and millions of years. And that's why people came across the continent and came down. They were following that kelp forest and all the food that lives in that kelp forest.
Right.
So we're seeing declines. It's different in each spot. Each spot kind of has its own story. Some spots it's the urchin issue. Some spots it's more about the otters. Some spots it's about the warm. I mean, the warm temperatures is a theme throughout.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, they're seeing changes up there as well. The loss of the sunflower sea star, you know, had huge impacts across this entire coast.
Yeah.
So that's been a major issue. And they're doing a lot of work up in Washington with the sunflower sea star and have been. They're putting them back in. They've been growing them and putting them back in the water. And so far, so good. So that's really exciting.
And they can send us some?
Well, no. You know what? It's tricky because California doesn't like it when you send species that weren't born.
I get it.
Totally. Understand.
Well, maybe Bodega Marine Lab can get to work on that then.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, we are getting closer towards the end of the show here. I'd like to remind folks again, you know, where can they see this, and can they host private screenings?
Yeah, most definitely. So we'll be at Bioneers towards the end of March, and we're on their website. We're hoping to do one in Mill Valley for Earth Day on Saturday, April 25th. That'll also be on the website, which is sequoiasoftheseed.org. And yes, we would love to host community screenings. In fact, since the film premiered in April, we've probably been in more than a dozen film festivals across the country, two in foreign land. We've also been asked to do a lot of community screenings, and like the one we did at the Palace, at the Dance Palace in Point Reyes. And they're just really fun and exciting. People are really, really interested in learning more. So, there's a way to contact us on the website if you're interested in hosting a community screening.
Awesome.
And we'll also be up in Humboldt for around Earth Day, showing the film with Surf Rider Humboldt chapter. In Arcata, and we'll also be doing a screening with the Yurok tribe in Klamath.
Excellent.
So, awesome. Yeah, please reach out to us if you have an idea about a local screening. We love doing community screenings. The conversations afterwards are really the most interesting part, and that's what's so exciting about showing the film in person and in community is being able to have a conversation afterwards.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then in terms of for folks that feel really inspired by what you're doing, like any sort of calls to action, anything that we can do as individuals to help turn the tide in this situation. I mean, I know there's kind of the large issues such as climate change that we collectively, you know, all needs immediate attention.
An acknowledgement.
but on a local level, for concerned citizens, is there any sort of avenue that you would suggest?
Yeah, I mean, on the website, we have a take action page, and there's a lot of resources there. And, you know, there's everything from, you know, writing your representatives and Congress people, you know, voicing your concern, asking them to make a difference, to other organizations, like Natasha mentioned earlier, Reef Check. You know, they have a program where you can become a kelp restoration diver. If diving isn't your thing, I always like to mention the whale tail grant, mm-hmm. which is if you have a whale tail on your car as a license plate, that $50 that you pay every year to register your vehicle goes into a big pot of money that gets granted to a lot of organizations that are doing great work up and down the state of California.
I never heard of that.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
You get a whale tail in the back of your car?
Yeah, the whale tail license plate.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's the easiest way for people to do something, to take action. It collects millions of dollars, mm-hmm. and you can go online and find out who's been awarded funding. Mm-hmm. I think the best example for us in the last year was Reef Check. Mm-hmm. They got a large grant to enhance their Dive into Science program, which is in the film, which is where they're teaching people how to go scuba diving. And in our case, it was the Kashaya Band of Pomo Indians, helping them to understand kelp and the importance of it, and letting them see firsthand by diving into the water. So great programs, and probably the most universal, easiest thing for people to do.
Interesting. I have another kind of nuanced question about the kelp devastation since in the last 10 years. I know when this blob water hit and there was ecological change and had all this kelp being destroyed. Is that still happening? Is it still a decline, or has it bottomed out and now we're trying to figure out, or we're in a stage of trying to figure out how to recover it?
Mm-hmm. So basically, it's kind of stayed right around that 95% loss kind of window. Okay. We've seen a few summers ago, there was kind of good ocean conditions, and we saw a small uptick in kelp for sure along the entire coast. But we're talking, you know, maybe like 5% more of, you know, of a huge amount of loss.
Right.
So yes, we're seeing little upticks, but not enough.
Right.
And, you know, just to put it in context, kelp varies from year to year. We see different levels of kelp growth every year. And we've seen declines before, never to this extent, but it the following year, it goes back up, or 2 years later, you know, it fluctuates and it changes. What's so drastic and alarming about this is it's been, you know, it hasn't come back really at all in any significant way. I wouldn't say it's necessarily declining more.
Yeah, but it's flatlined pretty much.
But it's flatlined. Yeah. And we're
that was a question I was wondering, because I know you mentioned earlier that the urchins found like a new patch of kelp in one area and was feasting on it. I'm like, oh, are we still like in decline, or is it kind of flatlined at this point? So
it's pretty consistent, but we are seeing the sunflower sea star. I think, you know, we found some remnant populations that we didn't know about that were adults that survived the disease, and off the Sonoma coast, and that's very hopeful.
I love that. Well, it sounds like there's a lot of amazing good work out being done right now. So I want to keep my optimism out there. And for folks, if you haven't got a chance to see this show, the movie, it's amazing. Please get out there and see it.
Yeah.
Thank you guys so much.
Yeah, thanks for being with us. It's such an important story to get out, and I'm so glad you're here to share it. So
thanks for having us.
Of course. I hope you have a great rest of your day.
All right.
Likewise.
We'll take care of y'all, and then we will be back in a few weeks with a new episode.
We're actually going to be talking the Bird Fest on the next
one. Yeah, that's right. Bird Fest time is coming up.
Yeah. The Bird and
Ooh,
Nature
maybe
Festival.
We could get Sequoias of the Sea filmed at the Point Reyes Birding and Nature Festival. We're going to try to connect some dots. We'll send you an email.
This would be a great one. Oh, totally. I love that. I love that dot connection.
Totally right.
Yeah.
Let's do it.
All right.
Thanks, guys.
Well, thanks, y'all. Enjoy your day.
All right.
Thank you.
So we'll see y'all in a couple weeks, and take care, y'all. Have a great Monday.
Hey, everybody. This is John Doe.